By now, I'm sure you can tell that it doesn't take much for me to become obsessed. Some criticize my level of passion, but I'm not down with the prevailing mentalities that tend to dominate American society these days. The ones that tell us to go with the flow or invite us to learn how to get more with less effort. Fuck that shortcut bullshit. The reason I embrace my own obsessions and demand and desire more of myself is because I've learned that it's only when I push beyond pain and suffering, past my perceived limitations, that I'm capable of accomplishing more, physically and mentally, in endurance races, but also in life as a whole. And I believe the same is true for you. The human body is like a stock car. We may look different on the outside, but under the hood, we all have huge reservoirs of potential and a governor impeding us from reaching our maximum velocity. In a car, the governor limits the flow of fuel and air so it doesn't burn too hot, which places a ceiling on performance. It's a hardware issue. The governor can easily be removed, and if you disable yours, watch your car rocket beyond 130 miles per hour. It's a subtler process in the human animal. Our governor is buried deep in our minds, intertwined with our very identity. It knows what and who we love and hate. It's read our whole life story and forms the way we see ourselves and how we like to be seen. It's the software that delivers personalized feedback in the form of pain and exhaustion, but also fear and insecurity. And it uses all of that to encourage us to stop before we risk it all. But here's the thing. It doesn't have absolute control. Unlike the governor in an engine, ours can't stop us unless we buy into its bullshit and agree to quit. Sadly, most of us give up when we've only given around 40% of our maximum effort. Even when we feel like we've reached our absolute limit, we still have 60% more to give. That's the governor in action. Once you know that to be true, it's simply a matter of stretching your pain tolerance, letting go of your identity, and all your self-limiting stories, so you can get to 60%, then 80%, and beyond without giving up. I call this the 40% rule, and the reason it's so powerful is that if you follow it, you will unlock your mind to new levels of performance and excellence in sports and in life, and your rewards will run far deeper than mere material success. The 40% rule can be applied to everything we do, because in life, almost nothing will turn out exactly as we hope. There are always challenges, and whether we are at work or school or feeling tested within our most intimate or important relationships, we will all be tempted to walk away from commitments, give up on our goals and dreams, and sell our own happiness short at some point. Because we will feel empty, like we have no more to give, when we haven't tapped even half of the treasure buried deep in our minds, hearts, and souls. I know how it feels to be approaching an energetic dead end. I've been there too many times to count. I understand the temptation to sell short, but I also know that impulse is driven by your mind's desire for comfort, and it's not telling you the truth. It's your identity trying to find sanctuary, not help you grow. It's looking for status quo, not reaching for greatness or seeking wholeness. But the software update that you need to shut your governor down is no supersonic download. It takes 20 years to gain 20 years of experience. And the only way to move beyond your 40% is to callous your mind day after day, which means you'll have to chase pain like it's your damn job. Imagine you're a boxer, and on your first day in the ring, you take one on the chin. It's gonna hurt like fucking hell. But at year 10 of being a boxer, you won't be stopped by one punch. You'll be able to absorb 12 rounds of getting beat the fuck down and come back the very next day and fight again. It's not that the punch has lost power. Your opponents will be even stronger. The change has happened within your brain. You've calloused your mind. Over a period of time, your tolerance for mental and physical suffering will have expanded because your software will have learned that you can take a hell of a lot more than one punch. And if you stay with any task that is trying to beat you down, you will reap rewards. Not a fighter? Say you like to run, but have a broken pinky toe. I'll bet if you continue running on it, pretty soon you'll be able to run on broken legs. Sounds impossible, right? I know it's true, because I've run on broken legs, and that knowledge helped me endure all manner of agonies on the ultra circuit, which has revealed a clear spring of self-confidence that I drink from whenever my tank is dry. But nobody taps their reserve 60% right away, or all at once. The first step is to remember that your initial blast of pain and fatigue is your governor talking. Once you do that, you are in control of the dialogue in your mind and you can remind yourself that you are not as drained as you think, that you haven't given it your all, not even close. Buying into that will keep you in the fight, and that's worth an extra 5%. Of course, that's easier said than done. It wasn't easy to begin the fourth lap of the Hurt 100 because I knew how much it would hurt. And when you are feeling dead and buried, dehydrated, wrung out, and torn the fuck up at 40%, finding that extra 60% feels impossible. I didn't want my suffering to continue. Nobody does. That's why the line, "Fatigue makes cowards of us all," is true as shit. Mind you, I didn't know anything about the 40% rule that day. The Hurt 100 is when I first started to contemplate it. But I had hit the wall many times before, and I had learned to stay present and open-minded enough to recalibrate my goals even at my lowest. I knew that staying in the fight is always the hardest and most rewarding first step. Of course, it's easy to be open-minded when you leave yoga class and are taking a stroll by the beach, but when you're suffering, keeping an open mind is hard work. The same is true if you're facing a daunting challenge on the job or at school. Maybe you are tackling a 100-question test and know that you've bricked the first 50. At that point, it's extremely difficult to maintain the necessary discipline to force yourself to keep taking the test seriously. It's also imperative that you find it, because in every failure, there is something to be gained, even if it's only practice for the next test you'll have to take. Because that next test is coming. That's a guarantee. I didn't start my fourth lap with any sort of conviction. I was in wait-and-see mode, and halfway up that first climb, I became so dizzy, I had to sit under a tree for a while. Two runners passed me, one at a time. They checked in, but I waved them on, told them I was just fine. Yeah, I was doing great. I was a regular Akos Konya. From my vantage point, I could see the crest of the hill above and encouraged myself to walk at least that far. If I still wanted to quit after that, I told myself that I would be willing to sign off and that there is no shame in not finishing the Hurt 100. I said that to myself again and again because that's how our governor works. It massages your ego even as it stops you short of your goals. But once I got to the top of the climb, the higher ground gave me a new perspective, and I saw another place off in the distance and decided to cover that small stretch of mud, rock, and root too. You know, before quitting for good. Once I got there, I was staring down a long descent, and even though the footing was troubling, it still looked much easier than going uphill. Without realizing it, I'd gotten to a point where I was able to strategize. On the first climb, I was so dizzy and weak, I was swept into a moment of fuck, which clogged my brain. There was no room for strategy. I just wanted to quit. But by moving a little bit further, I'd reset my brain. I'd calm down and realize I could chunk the race down to size. And staying in the game like that gave me hope. And hope is addictive. I chunked the race out that way, collecting 5% chips, unlocking more energy, then burning it up as time bled into the wee hours. I became so tired I damn near fell asleep on my feet. And that's dangerous on a trail, with so many switchbacks and drop-offs. Any runner could have easily sleepwalked into oblivion. The one thing keeping me awake was the piss-poor trail condition. I fell on my ass dozens of times. My street shoes were out of their element. It felt like I was running on ice, and the inevitable fall was always jarring. But at least it woke me up. By running a little while, then walking a stretch, I was able to forge ahead to mile 77, the toughest descent of them all, which is when I saw Carl Meltzer, the speed goat, crest the hill behind me. He wore a lamp on his head and another on his wrist and a hip pack with two big water bottles. Silhouetted in pink dawn light, he charged down slope, navigating a section that had me stumbling and groping for tree branches to stay upright. He was about to lap me, 3 miles from the finish line, on pace for a course record, 22 hours and 16 minutes. But what I remember most is how graceful he looked running at an incredible 6 minute and 30 second per mile pace. He was levitating over the mud, riding a whole different zen. His feet barely touched the ground, and it was a beautiful fucking sight. The speed goat was the living, breathing answer to the question that colonized my mind after the Las Vegas marathon. What am I capable of? Watching that bad man glide across the most challenging terrain made me realize that there is a whole other level of athlete out there in the world, and that some of that was inside me too. In fact, it's in all of us. I'm not saying that genetics don't play a role in athletic performance, or that everyone has an undiscovered ability to run a 4-minute mile, dunk like LeBron James, shoot like Steph Curry, or run the Hurt 100 in 22 hours. We don't all have the same floor or ceiling, but we each have a lot more in us than we know. And when it comes to endurance sports, like ultra running, everyone can achieve feats they once thought impossible. In order to do that, we must change our minds, be willing to scrap our identity, and make the extra effort to always find more in order to become more. We must remove our governor. That day on the Hurt 100 circuit, after seeing Meltzer run like a superhero, I finished my fourth lap in all kinds of pain and took time to watch him celebrate, surrounded by his team. He'd just achieved something nobody had ever done before, and here I was with another full lap to go. My legs were rubber, my feet swollen. I did not want to go on, but I also knew that was my pain talking. My true potential was still undetermined. Looking back, I'd say I'd given 60%, which meant my tank was just shy of half full. I'd like to sit here and tell you I went all out and drained that fucker on lap 5, but I was still a mere tourist on Planet Ultra. I wasn't the master of my mind. I was in the laboratory, still in discovery mode, and I walked every single step of my fifth and final lap. It took me 8 hours, but the rain had stopped, the tropical glow of the warm Hawaiian sun felt phenomenal, and I got the job done. I finished Hurt 100 in 33 hours and 23 minutes, just shy of the 36-hour cutoff, good enough for ninth place. Only 23 athletes finished the entire race, and I was one of them. I was so thrashed afterward, two people carried me to the car, and Kate had to spin me up to my room in a damn wheelchair. When we got there, we had more work to do. I wanted to get my Badwater application done ASAP, so without so much as a cat nap, we polished that shit up. Within a matter of days, Kosman emailed me to let me know that I had been accepted into Badwater. It was a great feeling. It also meant that for the next 6 months, I had two full-time jobs. I was a Navy SEAL in full preparation mode for Badwater. This time, I would get strategic and specific because I knew that in order to unleash my best performance, if I wanted to blow past 40%, drain my tank, and tap my full potential, I had to first give myself an opportunity. I didn't research or prepare for the Hurt 100 well enough. I hadn't anticipated the rough terrain, I had no support crew for the first part of the race, and I had no backup water source. I didn't bring two headlamps, which would have helped during the long, bleak night, and though I sure felt like I had given everything I had, I never even had a chance to access my true 100%. You know, before we get into Badwater prep, I think we should just recap what just happened.
Yeah, this was another one and another one right here. Now, so I started realizing right here, well, I started figuring some things out going through, you know, my hell weeks, you know, all this other crap. That 100-mile race, the Las Vegas, you know, marathon. But what's the one thing? What's the one thing that you think, Adam, in this race right here that made me start to think about this 40% rule that I made up? What do you think is the one thing?
You know, I never asked you that question. What the one thing that made you start to think of that? And I have to say, it's Carl Meltzer.
Carl Meltzer was a little fraction of that. But what it was, as you're reading this, is there anybody around me? Am I racing anybody? I'm truly alone. So I was alone in my own thoughts, in my own mind.
For a long time.
For a long time.
It's like a hell week without anybody around you.
Right. And I'm talking about, even though it's a five loop course, man, it's almost like you're out there by yourself. There's almost 100 people out there. And once I got past, you know, me and Luis Escobar kind of split off and he took off, I saw Akos and then I saw Carl Meltzer. That was it. You know, I had like another 30 miles or whatever it was left. And I was out there just walking around this daggone jungle, triple canopy jungle, by myself.
With nothing to feed off, nobody to feed off but yourself.
Exactly. So then I went into my mind, to that cookie jar I was talking about, and I started thinking about, okay, man, I need more ways to get through this, man. How am I going to do this? How am I going to do this? And the one thing I realized is it's impossible to find that whole 40% rule, find more, find 60, 70, 80% if you're competing. If you're competing against somebody, that's not the time to start trying to find more. When you're by yourself, you can do a live autopsy because you're not competing with anybody. You're competing against yourself and only yourself. And my best races always came when I went into the race just against David Goggins. There may be 1,000 people in the race, but when I ran my own race and was in my own head and did my own thing, that's exactly where this starts. So that's why I was able to figure out all these different tools over the 40%. Cause I was, okay, how can I get from here to there?
You're saying that when you're trying to defeat an opponent in a race or a competition without focusing on just what you have to do to get through the race at your full potential, you actually get less strategic. You get kind of out of your body.
Right. What happens is when you're racing somebody, you start to run their race.
Mm.
And then you didn't train the way they did.
No.
You trained the way you did. So this gave me a lot of time to start figuring out my mind. Like I said, I became a scientist. And I was the project.
Mm.
I was the project. I was like, okay, let me see. I'm at mile 40 and I'm done.
You were your own monster.
Exactly. I'm destroyed. So, you know, let's create, who is it? Frankenstein?
Yes.
And that's what I did.
Frankenstein, you became your own Frankenstein's monster.
That's it, man. And that's exactly, I had time out there by myself to think about the possibilities and how can I get from here to there? I'm broken. And it started right here.
So that's where it started. But, you know, now it's kind of a fully formed thing, the 40% rule. So we don't really go back into it. We don't really, with these principles, we don't then talk about the years later that you polished it.
Right.
About how long was it before you kind of really put a name to it and really understood it as a rule? Was it 5 years? Was it 10 years? How long was it before you really realized, you know, hey, this is the 40%. This is the governor. This is everything.
I believe I was doing an interview around 2008.
Okay.
Somewhere around there. So I did a race called it was called McNaughton. It was a 150-mile race. That's not in the book. It was a 150-mile race. And the first year I did it, I went out there and got double pneumonia and walked with a guy named Mike. We have to talk about Mike here in the book. A guy named Mike, I walked 90 miles. Oh, my fault. No.
Ryan Dexter?
No. This was Mike.
Okay.
The guy we talk about who's in New York.
Yeah.
With the family.
Oh, that's him. Right.
So basically what happened was I ran the first 90 miles of a 150-mile race, and at mile 90, I was destroyed. Something happened. I had double pneumonia. Once again, those lung issues came up, and I decided to walk the next 60 miles, and Mike walked with me. The second time I went back, I literally said to everybody, I'm going to come back out here the very next year, and I'm going to crush this course. And I went back out, and I beat the course record by like 2 hours, and I beat my previous time by like 8 hours. And this company for Lexus was following me around this track, or not, it was like a 10-mile loop, and I did it 15 times for 100 miles. It's in trails. It was nasty, muddy, raining, cold as hell. And this Lexus person was talking to me the whole time. They actually, you know, didn't work for Lexus. I guess Lexus hired him for some commercial and they were doing whatever. And that's where I came up with it at. Cause I was out there and I was like, man, you know what? I started having more time to reflect on how much I was leaving on the table. But then I started figuring out there's actually steps on how to break down that governor that we put on our minds.
Right.
So I started figuring out the steps. It wasn't like, oh, I'm just going to push harder. No, it wasn't like that. All these different, there's actually steps on how to open that up. But nowadays, a lot of people don't want to do that. Why? Because it is so comfortable nowadays. Life is so comfortable. It's so easy to be comfortable. I'm looking around and here in LA, you know, we're here doing this audio book. Everybody has some little scooter. You know, I'm like, what the hell's all these damn scooters, man? I'm like, hey, walk your ass to the fucking store. Everybody's got either a sit down scooter, a stand up scooter.
Yeah.
You know, all these bikes that, you know, you have to pay for, those bikes are all rusted and crushed. Nobody's getting a bike. I got a scooter.
Right.
So the mind is just getting weaker and weaker and weaker. So trying to find this extra 60%, you really have to go back to the granimalistic mindset that we had back in the day.
Love it. But long before that, well, a few years before that, you're still kind of a neophyte, like you said, in Planet
Huge
Ultra.
Neophyte. Huge.
But you knew that there was so much more. I mean, you were done after 3 laps. I mean, you were trashed and yet you did 40 more miles of this hellish course. and you hadn't even really prepared. You hadn't really even put yourself in a position to get to 100. So you knew there was this gap there.
Oh, 100%, because this gave me a lot of time also in the Hurt 100 to think about the first 100-mile race I did with no training. And then going out to the daggone Las Vegas Marathon, I'm thinking, God, dog. So that actually gave me tons of fuel to start discovering even more in this race. Because I was thinking, once again, the cookie jar. I went back in the cookie jar in my mind, started thinking, hang on a second, David, you're broke down at mile 40, but you were shitting on yourself at mile 70 in the first race you did.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, we got some more.
Badwater was going to be different. I researched day and night. I studied the course, noted temperature and elevation variances, and charted them out. I wasn't just interested in the air temperature. I drilled down deeper, so I knew how hot the pavement would be on the hottest Death Valley day ever. I Googled videos of the race and watched them for hours. I read blogs from runners who completed it. I noted their pitfalls and training techniques. I drove north to Death Valley and explored the entire course. Seeing the terrain up close revealed its brutality. The first 42 miles were dead flat, a run through God's blast furnace cranked up high. That would be my best opportunity to make good time. But to survive it, I'd need two crew vehicles to leapfrog one another and set up cooling stations every third of a mile. The thought of it thrilled me, but then again, I wasn't living it yet. I was listening to music, windows down on a spring day in a blooming desert. I was comfortable as hell. It was all still a fucked up fantasy. I marked off the best spots to set up my cooling stations. I noted wherever the shoulder was wide and where stopping would have to be avoided. I also took note of gas stations and other places to fill up on water and buy ice. There weren't many of them, but they were all mapped. After running the desert gauntlet, I'd earn some relief from the heat and pay for it with altitude. The next stage of the race was an 18-mile climb to Town Pass at 4,800 feet. The sun would be setting by then, and after driving that section, I pulled over, closed my eyes, and visualized it all. Research is one part of preparation. Visualization is another. Following that Town Pass climb, I would face a bone-crushing 9-mile descent. I could see it unfurl from the top of the pass. One thing I learned from the Hurt 100 is that running downhill fucks you up bad, and this time I'd be doing it on asphalt. I closed my eyes, opened my mind, and tried to feel the pain in my quads and calves, knees and shins. I knew my quads would bear the brunt of that descent, so I made a note to add muscle. My thighs would need to be plated in steel. The 18-mile climb up Darwin Pass from mile 72 would be pure hell. I'd have to run walk that section. But the sun would be down, I'd welcome the chill in Lone Pine, and from there I could make up some time because that's where the road flattened out again before the final 13-mile climb up Whitney Portal Road to the finish line at 8,374 feet. Then again, it's easy to write, make up time in your notepad, and another to execute it when you get there in real life. But at least I had notes. Together with my annotated maps, they made up my Badwater file, which I studied like I was preparing for another ASVAB test. I sat at my kitchen table, read and reread them, and visualized each mile the best I could. But I also knew that my body still hadn't recovered from Hawaii, which hampered the other, even more important aspect of my Badwater prep, physical training. I was in dire need of PT, but my tendons still hurt so bad I couldn't run for months. Pages were flying off the calendar. I needed to get harder and become the strongest runner possible, and the fact that I couldn't train like I'd hoped sapped my confidence. Plus, word had gotten out at work about what I was getting myself into, and while I had some support from fellow SEALs, I got my share of negativity too, especially when they found out I still couldn't run. But that was nothing new. Who hasn't dreamed up a possibility for themselves only to have friends, colleagues, or family shit all over it? Most of us are motivated as hell to do anything to pursue our dreams until those around us remind us of the danger, the downside, our own limitations, and all the people before us that didn't make it. Sometimes the advice comes from a well-intentioned place. They really believe they are doing it for our own good, but if you let them, these same people will talk you out of your dreams, and your governor will help them do it. That's one reason I invented the cookie jar. We must create a system that constantly reminds us who the fuck we are when we are at our best, because life is not going to pick us up when we fall. There will be forks in the road, knives in your fucking back, mountains to climb, and we are only capable of living up to the image we create for ourselves. Prepare yourself. We know life can be hard, and yet we feel sorry for ourselves when it isn't fair. From this point forward, accept the following as Goggin's laws of nature. You will be made fun of. You will feel insecure. You may not be the best all the time. You may be the only black, white, Asian, Latino, female, male, gay, lesbian, or fill in your identity here in a given situation. There will be times when you feel alone. Get over it. Our minds are fucking strong. They are our most powerful weapon, but we have stopped using them. We have access to so many more resources today than ever before, yet we are so much less capable than those who came before us. If you want to be one of the few to defy those trends in our ever-softening society, you will have to be willing to go to war with yourself and create a whole new identity, which requires an open mind. It's funny. Being open-minded is often tagged as new age or soft. Fuck that. Being open-minded enough to find a way is old school. It's what knuckle-draggers do. And that's exactly what I did. I borrowed my friend Stokes' bike. He also graduated in class 235. And instead of running to work, I rode there and back every day. There was an elliptical trainer in the brand new SEAL Team 5 gym, and I hit it once and sometimes twice a day, with 5 layers of clothes on. Death Valley heat scared the shit out of me, so I simulated it. I suited up in 3 or 4 pairs of sweatpants and a few pullover sweatshirts, a hoodie and a fleece hat, all sealed up in a Gore-Tex shell. After 2 minutes on the elliptical, my heart rate was at 170, and I stayed at it for 2 hours at a time. Before or after that, I'd hop on the rowing machine and bang out 30,000 meters, which is nearly 20 miles. I never did anything for 10 or 20 minutes. My entire mindset was ultra. It had to be. Afterward, I could be seen wringing my clothes out like I just soaked them in a river. Most of the guys thought I was whacked out, but my old buds instructor, SBG, fucking loved it. That spring, I was tasked as a land warfare instructor for SEALs at our base in Nyland, California, a sorry scrap of Southern California desert, its trailer parks rampant with unemployed meth heads. Drugged-out drifters who filtered through the disintegrating settlements on the Salton Sea, an inland body of water 60 miles from the Mexico border, were our only neighbors. Whenever I passed them on the street while out on a 10-mile ruck, they'd stare like I was an alien that had materialized into the real world from one of their speed-addled vision quests. Then again, I was dressed in 3 layers of clothes and a Gore-Tex jacket in peak 100-degree heat. I did look like some evil messenger from the way out beyond. By then, my injuries had become manageable, and I ran 10 miles at a time, then hiked the hills around Nyland for hours, weighed down with a 50-pound ruck. The team guys I was training considered me an alien being, too, and a few of them were more frightened of me than the meth heads. They thought something had happened to me on the battlefield out in that other desert where war wasn't a game. What they didn't know was the battlefield for me was my own mind. I drove back out to Death Valley to train and did a 10-mile run in a sauna suit. That motherfucker was hot as balls, but I had the hardest race in the world ahead of me, and I'd run 100 miles twice. I knew how that felt, and the prospect of having to take on an additional 35 miles petrified me. Sure, I talked a good game, projected all kinds of confidence, and raised tens of thousands of dollars. But part of me didn't know if I had what it took to finish the race, so I had to invent barbaric PT to give myself a chance. It takes a lot of will to push yourself when you are all alone. I hated getting up in the morning, knowing what the day held for me. It was very lonely. But I knew that on the Badwater course, I'd reach a point where the pain would become unbearable and feel insurmountable. Maybe it would be at mile 50 or 60. Maybe later. But there would be a time when I'd want to quit, and I had to be able to slay the one-second decisions in order to stay in the game and access my untapped 60%. During all the lonely hours of heat training, I'd started to dissect the quitting mind and realized that if I was going to perform close to my absolute potential and make the Warrior Foundation proud, I'd have to do more than answer the simple question as they came up. I'd have to stifle the quitting mind before it gained any traction at all. Before I ever asked myself why, I'd need my cookie jar on recall to convince me that despite what my body was saying, I was immune to suffering. Because nobody quits an ultra race or hell week in a split second. People make the decision to quit hours before they ring that bell. So I needed to be present enough to recognize when my body and mind were starting to fail in order to short-circuit the impulse to look for a way out, long before I tumbled into that fatal funnel. Ignoring pain or blocking out the truth like I did at the San Diego One Day would not work this time. And if you are on the hunt for your 100%, you should catalog your weaknesses and vulnerabilities. Don't ignore them. be prepared for them, because in any endurance event, in any high-stress environment, your weaknesses will surface like bad karma, build in volume, and overwhelm you, unless you get ahead of them first. This is an exercise in recognition and visualization. You must recognize what you are about to do, highlight what you do not like about it, and spend time visualizing each and every obstacle you can. I was afraid of the heat, so in the run-up to Badwater, I imagined new and more medieval self-torture rituals disguised as training sessions. Or maybe it was the other way around. I told myself I was immune to suffering, but that didn't mean I was immune to pain. I hurt like everybody else, but I was committed to working my way around and through it so it would not derail me. By the time I towed up to the line at Badwater at 6 a.m. on July 22, 2006, I'd moved my governor to 80%. I'd doubled my ceiling in 6 months. And you know what that guaranteed me? Jack fucking shit. Badwater has a staggered start. Rookies started at 6 a.m., veteran runners had an 8 a.m. start, and the true contenders wouldn't take off until 10 a.m., which put them in Death Valley for peak heat. Chris Kossman was one hilarious son of a bitch. But he didn't know he'd given one hard motherfucker a serious tactical advantage. Not me. I'm talking about Akos Konya. Akos and I met up the night before at the Furnace Creek Inn, where all the athletes stayed. He was a first-timer, too. And he looked a hell of a lot better since the last time we saw one another. Despite his issues at the Hurt 100, he finished, by the way, in 35 hours and 17 minutes. I knew Akos was a stud, and since we were both in the first group, I let him pace me through the desert. Bad call. For the first 17 miles, we were side by side, and we looked like an odd couple. Akos is a 5'7", 122-pound Hungarian. I was the biggest man in the field at 6'1", 195 pounds. And the only black guy, too. Akos was sponsored and dressed in a colorful branded getup. I wore a torn gray tank top, black running shorts, and streamlined Oakley sunglasses. My feet and ankles were wrapped in compression tape and stuffed into broken-in but still springy running shoes. I didn't wear Navy SEAL gear or Warrior Foundation garb. I preferred to go incognito. I was the shadow figure filtering into a new world of pain. Although Akos set a fast pace, the heat didn't bother me. Partly because it was early, and because I'd heat trained so well. We were the two best runners in the 6 a.m. group by far, and when we passed the Furnace Creek Inn at 8:40 a.m., some of the runners from the 10 a.m. group were outside, including Scott Jurek, the defending champion, Badwater record holder, and an ultra legend. He must have known we were making great time, but I'm not sure he realized that he just glimpsed his stiffest competition. Not long after, Akos put some space between us, and at mile 26, I started to realize that, once again, I went out way too fast. I was dizzy and lightheaded, and I was dealing with GI issues. Translation, I had to shit on the side of the road. All of which stemmed from the fact that I was severely dehydrated. My mind spun with dire prognosis after dire prognosis. Excuses to quit piled up one after another. I didn't listen. I responded by taking care of my dehydration issue and pounding more water than I wanted. I went through the stovepipe wells checkpoint at mile 42 at 1:31 p.m., a full hour after Akos. I'd been on the race course for over 7.5 hours and was almost exclusively walking by then. I was proud just to have made it through Death Valley on my feet. I took a break, went to a proper bathroom, and changed my clothes. My feet had swollen more than I'd expected, and my right big toe had been chafing the side of the shoe for hours, so stopping felt like sweet relief. I felt the bloom of a blood blister on the side of my left foot, but I knew better than to take off my shoes. Most athletes size up their shoes to run Badwater, and even then, they cut out the big toe side panel to create space for swelling and to minimize chafing. I did not, and I had 90 more miles ahead of me. I hiked the entire 18-mile climb to Town Pass at 4,850 feet. As predicted, the sun dropped as I crested the pass. The air cooled, and I pulled on another layer. In the military, we always say we don't rise to the level of our expectations. We fall to the level of our training. And as I hiked up the winding highway with my blister barking, I fell into the same rhythm I'd find on my long rucks in the desert around Nyland. I wasn't running, but I kept a strong pace and covered a lot of ground. I stuck to my script, ran the entire 9-mile descent, and my quads paid the price. So did my left foot. My blister was growing by the minute. I could feel it verging on hot air balloon status. If only it would burst through the side of my shoe like an old cartoon and continued to expand until it carried me into the clouds and dropped me onto the peak of Mount Whitney itself. No such luck. I kept walking, and aside from my crew, which included, among others, my wife, Kate was crew chief, and mother, I didn't see anybody else. I was on an eternal ruck, marching beneath a black domed sky glittering with starlight. I'd been walking for so long I expected a swarm of runners to materialize at any moment, then leave me in their wake. But nobody showed. The only evidence of life on planet Pain was the rhythm of my own hot breath, the burn of my cartoon blister, and the high beams and red taillights of road trippers, blazing trails through the California night. That is, until the sun was ready to rise, and the swarm finally did arrive at mile 110. I was exhausted and dehydrated by then, glazed in sweat, dirt, and salt, when horseflies began to dive bomb me one at a time. Two became four, which became 10 and 15. They beat their wings against my skin, bit my thighs, and crawled into my ears. This shit was biblical, and it was my very last test. My crew took turns swatting flies off my skin with a towel. I was in personal best territory already. I'd covered more than 110 miles on foot, and with only 25 miles to go, there was no fucking way these devil flies would stop me. Would they? I kept marching, and my crew kept swatting flies for the next 8 miles. Since watching Akos run away from me after mile 17, I hadn't seen another Badwater runner until mile 122, when Kate pulled up alongside me. "Scott Jurek is 2 miles behind you," she said. We were more than 26 hours into the race, and Akos had already finished, but the fact that Jurek was just now catching me meant my time must have been pretty damn good. I hadn't run much, but all those Nyland rucks made my hiking strides swift and strong. I was able to power hike 15-minute miles and got my nutrition on the move to save time. After it was all over, when I examined the splits and finishing times of all the competitors, I realized my biggest fear, the heat, had actually helped me. It was the great equalizer. It made fast runners slow. With Jurek on the hunt, I was inspired to give it everything I had as I turned onto Whitney Portal Road and started the final 13-mile climb. I flashed onto my pre-race strategy to walk the slopes and run the flats as the road switched back like a snake, slithering into the clouds. Jurek wasn't pursuing me, but he was on the chase. Akos had finished in 25 hours and 58 minutes, and Jurek hadn't been at his best that day. The clock was winding down on his effort to repeat as Badwater champion, but he had the tactical advantage of knowing Akos's time in advance. He also knew his splits. Akos hadn't had that luxury, and somewhere on the highway, he'd stopped for a 30-minute nap. Jurek wasn't alone. He had a pacer, a formidable runner in his own right named Dusty Olson, who nipped at his heels. Word was, Olson ran at least 70 miles of the race himself. I heard them approach from behind, and whenever the road switched back, I could see them below me. Finally, at mile 128, on the steepest part of the steepest road in this entire fucked-up race, they were right behind me. I stopped running, got out of the way, and cheered them on. Jurek was the fastest ultra-runner in history at that point, but his pace wasn't electric that late in the game. It was consistent. He chopped down the mighty mountain with each deliberate step. He wore black running shorts, a blue sleeveless shirt, and a white baseball cap. Behind him, Olson had his long, shoulder-length hair corralled with a bandana. Otherwise, their uniform was identical. Jurek was the mule, and Olson was riding him. "Come on, Jerker! Come on, Jerker! This is your race!" Olson said as they passed me up. "No one is better than you. No one!" Olson kept talking as they ran ahead, reminding Jurek that he had more to give. Jurek obliged and kept charging up the mountain. He left it all out on that unforgiving asphalt. It was amazing to watch. Jurek wound up winning the 2006 edition of Badwater when he finished in 25 hours and 41 minutes, 17 minutes faster than Akos, who must have regretted his power nap. But that wasn't my concern. I had a race of my own to finish. Whitney Portal Road winds up a parched, exposed rock escarpment for 10 miles, before finding shade and gathering stands of cedar and pine. Energized by Jurek and his crew, I ran most of the last 7 miles. I used my hips to push my legs forward, and every single step was agony. But after 30 hours, 18 minutes, and 54 seconds of running, hiking, sweating, and suffering, I snapped the tape to the cheers of a small crowd. I'd wanted to quit 30 times. I had to mentally inch my way through 135 miles. But 90 runners competed that day, and I came in 5th place. I plodded over to a grassy slope in the woods and lay back on a bed of pine needles as Kate unlaced my shoes. That blister had fully colonized my left foot. It was so big it looked like a sixth toe, the color and texture of cherry bubblegum. I marveled at it while she removed the compression tape from my feet. Then I staggered to the stage to accept my medal from Kosman. I just finished one of the hardest races on planet Earth. I'd visualized that moment 10 times at least and thought I'd be elated, but I wasn't. He handed me my medal, shook my hand, and interviewed me for the crowd, but I was only half there. While he spoke, I flashed the final climb and a pass above 8,000 feet where the view was unreal. I could see all the way to Death Valley. Near the end of another horrible journey, I got to see where I came from. It was the perfect metaphor for my twisted life. Once again, I was broken, destroyed 20 different ways, but I'd passed another evolution, another crucible, and my reward was a lot more than a medal and a few minutes with Kosman's microphone. It was a whole new bar. I closed my eyes and saw Jurek and Olsen, Akos and Carl Meltzer. All of them had something I didn't. They understood how to drain every last drop and put themselves in a position to win the world's most difficult races, and it was time to seek out that feeling for myself. I'd prepared like a madman. I knew myself and the terrain. I stayed ahead of the quitting mind, answered the simple questions, and stayed in the race. But there was more to be done. There was still somewhere higher for me to rise. A cool breeze rustled the trees, dried the sweat from my skin, and soothed my aching bones. It whispered in my ear and shared a secret which echoed in my brain like a drumbeat that wouldn't stop. There is no finish line, Goggins. There is no finish line.
I absolutely loved that race. That race taught me a lot. And what's funny about that, I was going back through it, and that whole little grassy, that grassy area with the tree where I kind of went over to.
Yep.
And my ex-wife now, she's not my ex-wife, she was taking the tape off of my feet because I actually, as you know, the listener knows now, I had to tape up my ankles with compression tape, and she was taking it off. But how that all came to be, I believe the movie, they actually did like a documentary on the on Badwater 135, and I think it's called Running on the Sun. And it kind of featured a guy named Gabriel Flores, and I think the guy's name was Eric Clifton, or just something like that. Anyway, but I watched a guy named Gabriel Flores, and I watched this video probably 200 times from the time I got in the Badwater race to the time I did the Badwater race. And Gabriel Flores came in second place that year. The year before the documentary, he actually won the race. So I wanted to see how he ran the race. I was trying to get ideas from him, how his crewing was, how his pacing was, all these different things. But what I saw was the very end of the race. He's going up the mountain. He's all messed up, and his crew's asking him questions. Hey, why are you out here? And I think he just said, you know, he said pride. He said pride. Or what's keeping you going? He said pride. So he comes up the mountain. He gets to the very top of the mountain, and the same spot that I went and sat down at, you know, when I crossed the finish line, was the same spot Gabriel Flores crossed. And the whole reason why I'm telling you the story was I was visualizing that spot for about 120 miles. I was visualizing that movie. I was visualizing, you know, me driving through Death Valley, all the checkpoints. But I was visualizing Gabriel Flores sitting down or laying down under that one tree in that one little grassy area. In if you all go to Badwater videos, just Google Badwater 135 2006 David Goggins, and you'll see my ex-wife taking the tape off me. And that one spot that I'm sitting in, I visualized that one spot a million times. So it's just an interesting story.
That's interesting. And what I like about this whole thing is, unlike Hurt 100, you got some miles in for that, and San Diego one day. This really does show when you prepare, like you break down here, that it can have success because of Nyland, you were able to power hike,
right,
which probably kept you in the race, right? If you had felt like you'd had to run, it would have been harder for you.
The only thing was that
you found a rhythm in the power hike. The heat training worked. I mean, you had so much that worked. You know, you had your two vehicles, all that work. So much of your preparation worked. So that had to be really encouraging for you. And part of the reason you felt like you could go even higher.
Well, I'm glad you talked about those two things, because those two things, I went back to my accountability mirror and I wrote down what are my weaknesses? I'm not a great runner. So I put that on my board. Not a great runner. Second of all, I was not great in the heat. So I kept repeating those things, and they kind of, you know, I was afraid of them. So literally, man, I was like, well, I guarantee you at about mile 40 or 50, man, my body's going to break down. So I had to really get that hiking muscle going. And if you run a lot and you don't walk, you can run a 5-minute mile. But if you haven't hiked a lot, you're not going to be a good runner, you know, like a good hiker. So I started, you know, working those different muscle groups, hiking a ton uphill. So I realized also at about mile 90, 100, I'm going to feel like shit. So I need to kind of mimic how I'm going to feel. So I put that 50-pound rucksack on, you know, during my training. And I lived in the sauna, because I knew that the one thing that gets people out there is the heat, and it's the great equalizer. And it made fast runners slow, as we talked about here.
Hmm. You know, I was just in Lone Pine, Bishop Berry in the Sierra Nevadas. And as we were driving up... those fucking horseflies started buzzing around.
Come on, man.
One of those horseflies landed on my fucking windshield when we were stopped at a light, like in Bishop or Lone Pine or something.
Yeah, that's where they're at.
And I said to my wife, I'm like, that's one of those flies. And she could not fucking believe it, because she'd read that.
Dude.
And she couldn't even fucking believe a swarm of those motherfuckers.
It was biblical. It was literally biblical. And another thing that jacked me up, so I'm out there running, and I always heard stories about people frying eggs on the daggone pavement out there. Mm. And so, you know, like, hey, you gotta run on the white line because the daggone, you know, pavement's like, you know, it's like 220 or whatever. I was like, man, this is a bunch of bullshit. I'll never forget going through mile 42 at Stovepipe Wells, and this guy was out there frying an egg on the pavement just to make you think, what the fuck am I doing out here? Mm. And I was like, and I looked down and I said, my God, man, this is some hot shit. So yeah, it was a no joke race.
Crazy, dude.
And I also have a picture of my toe in the book.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's, it's a nice, great picture of that nice. It looks like like you got a red balloon.
Yeah.
You kind of blew it up and put it over my toe.
That's it. That's where we got the description from, man.
Exactly.
Very good. All right, let's give these guys a challenge, because it's time for our listeners and readers to start to ratchet up and find some of that extra 60% that they've been kind of leaving in the tank. Challenge number 7. The main objective here is to slowly start to remove the governor from your brain. First, a quick reminder of how this process works. In 1999, when I weighed 297 pounds, my first run was a quarter mile. Fast forward to 2007, I ran 205 miles in 39 hours, nonstop. I didn't get there overnight, and I don't expect you to either. Your job is to push past your normal stopping point. Whether you are running on a treadmill or doing a set of push-ups, get to the point where you are so tired and in pain that your mind is begging you to stop. Then push just 5 to 10% further. If the most push-ups you have ever done is 100 in a workout, do 105 or 110. If you normally run 30 miles each week, run 10% more next week. This gradual ramp-up will help prevent injury and allow your body and mind to slowly adapt to your new workload. It also resets your baseline, which is important because you're about to increase your workload another 5 to 10% the following week and the week after that. There is so much pain and suffering involved in physical challenges that it's the best training to take command of your inner dialogue. And the newfound mental strength and confidence you gain by continuing to push yourself physically will carry over to other aspects in your life. You will realize that if you are underperforming in your physical challenges, there is a good chance you are underperforming at school and work too. The bottom line is that life is one big mind game. The only person you are playing against is yourself. Stick with this process, and soon what you thought was impossible will be something you do every fucking day of your life. I want to hear your stories. Post on social. Hashtags, #can't hurt me. Hashtag the 40% rule. Hashtag don't get comfortable. Anything you want to add to that?
Yeah. I mean, just one quick thing. Understand this. There's a big caution in this whole chapter. Do not do what I did. That is, and what I mean by that is, I figured out the 40% rule from literally destroying myself. Don't go out here and say, oh, David Goggins ran 100 miles, no training. Oh, I can go do that. You might be able to, but the whole thing about it is you have to do this 5, 10. Some of you maybe will go 20% more, but the whole thing is don't go from 0 to 100 because it will jack you up.
Yeah, I mean, just do it as you prescribe here, 5 to 10% each week. And the point is, if you do that, you'll realize there isn't, it's infinite where you can go.
100%.
You'll never get to 100. That's the point.
Matter of fact, I put a ceiling on mine for a little bit because I jacked my body up so much, I wasn't able to heal. So I was, you know, running, taping myself up, trying to find different heel wedges and different inserts just to run. So when your body's broken, you know, I had to go so deep in my mind to pull it off that, you know, it was unbelievable. So don't do it my way. Do it this way.
Chapter 8, Talent Not Required. The night before the first long-distance triathlon in my life, I sit with my mother on the deck of a sprawling $7 million beach house in Kona, watching the moonlight play on the water. Most people know Kona, a gorgeous town on the west coast of the island of Hawaii, and triathlons in general, thanks to the Ironman World Championships. Although there are far more Olympic distance and shorter sprint triathlons held around the world than there are Ironman events, it was the original Ironman in Kona that placed the sport on the international radar. It starts with a 2.4-mile swim, followed by a 112-mile bike ride, and closes with a marathon run. Add to that stiff and shifting winds and blistering heat corridors reflected by harsh lava fields, and the race reduces most competitors to open blisters of raw anguish. But I wasn't here for that. I came to Kona to compete in a less celebrated form of even more intense masochism. I was there to compete for the title of Ultraman. Over the next 3 days, I would swim 6.2 miles, ride 261 miles, and run a double marathon, covering the entire perimeter of the Big Island of Hawaii. Once again, I was raising money for the Special Operations Warrior Foundation, and because I'd been written up and interviewed on camera after Badwater, I was invited by a multimillionaire I'd never met to stay in his absurd palace on the sand in the run-up to the Ultraman World Championships in November 2006. It was a generous gesture, but I was so focused on becoming the very best version of myself, his glitz didn't impress me. In my mind, I still hadn't achieved shit. If anything, staying in his house only inflated the chip on my shoulder. He would never have invited my wannabe thug ass to come chill with him in Kona luxury back in the day. He only reached out because I'd become somebody a rich guy like him wanted to know. Still, I appreciated being able to show my mom a better life. And whenever I was offered a taste, I invited her to experience it with me. She'd swallowed more pain than anyone I'd ever known, and I wanted to remind her that we'd climbed out of that gutter, while I kept my own gaze locked at sewer level. We didn't live in that $7-a-month place in Brazil anymore, but I was still paying rent on that motherfucker, and will be for the rest of my life. The race launched from the beach beside the pier in downtown Kona, the same start line as the Ironman World Championships, but there wasn't much of a crowd for our race. There were only 30 athletes in the entire field, compared to over 1,200 in the Ironman. It was such a small group, I could look every one of my competitors in the eye and size them up, which is how I noticed the hardest man on the beach. I never did catch his name, but I'll always remember him, because he was in a wheelchair. Talk about heart. That man had a presence beyond his stature. He was fucking immense. Ever since I'd started up in Buds, I'd been in search of people like that. Men and women with an uncommon way of thinking. One thing that surprised me about military special operations was that some of the guys lived so mainstream. They weren't trying to push themselves every day of their lives, and I wanted to be around people who thought and trained uncommon 24/7, not just when duty called. That man had every excuse in the world to be at home, but he was ready to do one of the hardest stage races in the world, something 99.9% of the public wouldn't even consider, and with just his two arms. To me, He was what ultra racing was all about. And it's why after Badwater, I'd become hooked on this world. Talent wasn't required for this sport. It was all about heart and hard work. And it delivered relentless challenge after relentless challenge, always demanding more. But that doesn't mean I was well prepared for this race. I still didn't own a bike. I borrowed one 3 weeks earlier from another friend. It was a Griffin, an uber high-end bicycle, custom made for my friend who was even bigger than I was. I borrowed his clip-in shoes, too, which were just shy of clown-sized. I filled the empty space with thick socks and compression tape, and didn't take the time to learn bike mechanics before leaving for Kona. Changing tires, fixing chains and spokes, all the stuff I know how to do now, I hadn't learned yet. I just borrowed the bike and logged over 1,000 miles in the 3 weeks prior to Ultraman. I'd wake up at 4 a.m. and get 100-mile rides in before work. On weekends, I'd ride 125 miles, get off the bike and run a marathon. But I only did 6 training swims, just 2 in the open water. And in the ultra octagon, all your weaknesses are revealed. The 10-kilometer swim should have taken me about 2.5 hours to complete, but it took me over 3, and it hurt. I was dressed in a sleeveless wetsuit for buoyancy, but it was too tight under my arms, and within 30 minutes, my armpits began to chafe. An hour later, the salty edge of my suit had become sandpaper that ripped my skin with every stroke. I switched from freestyle to side stroke and back again, desperate for comfort that never came. Every revolution of my arms cut my skin raw and bloody on both sides. Plus, the sea was choppy as hell. I drank seawater. My stomach flipped and flopped like a fish suffocating in fresh air, and I puked a half dozen times at least. Because of the pain, my poor mechanics, and the strong current, I swam a meandering line that stretched to 7.5 miles. All of that in order to clear what was supposed to be a 6.2-mile swim. My legs were jelly when I staggered to shore, and my vision rocked like a teeter-totter during an earthquake. I had to lie down, then crawl behind the bathrooms, where I vomited again. Other swimmers gathered in the transition area, hopped into their saddles, and pedaled off into the lava fields in a blink. We still had a 90-mile bike ride to knock off before the day was done, and they were getting after it while I was still on my knees. Right on time, those simple questions bubbled to the surface. Why the fuck am I even out here? I'm not a triathlete. I'm chafed to hell, sick as fuck, and the first part of the ride is all uphill. Why do you keep doing this to yourself, Goggins? I sounded like a whiny bitch, but I knew finding some comfort would help me hem my vagina, so I paid no attention to the other athletes who eased through their transition. I had to focus on getting my legs under me and slowing my spun-out mind. First, I got some food down, a little at a time. Then I treated the cuts under my arms. Most triathletes don't change their clothes. I did. I slipped on some comfortable bike shorts and a Lycra shirt, and 15 minutes later, I was upright, in the saddle, and climbing into the lava fields. For the first 20 minutes, I was still nauseous. I pedaled and puked, replenished my fluids, and puked again. Through it all, I gave myself one job. Stay in the fight. Stay in it long enough to find a foothold. 10 miles later, as the road rose onto the shoulders of a giant volcano, and the incline increased, I shook off my sea legs and found momentum. Riders appeared ahead like bogeys on a radar, and I picked them off, one by one. Victory was a cure-all. Each time I passed another motherfucker, I got less and less sick. I was in 14th place when I saddled up. But by the time I approached the end of the 90-mile leg, there was only one man in front of me. Gary Wang, the favorite in the race. As I hammered toward the finish line, I could see a reporter and photographer from Triathlete magazine interviewing him. None of them expected to see my black ass, and they all watched me carefully. During the 4 months since Badwater, I'd often dreamt of being in a position to win an ultra race. And as I coasted past Gary and those reporters, I knew the moment had arrived. My expectations were intergalactic. The following morning, we lined up for the second stage, a 171-mile bike ride through the mountains and back toward the west coast. Gary Wang had a buddy in the race, Jeff Landauer, a.k.a. the Land Shark, and those two rode together. Gary had done the race before and knew the terrain. I didn't, and by mile 100, I was roughly 6 minutes off the lead. As usual, my mother and Kate were my two-headed support crew. They handed me replacement water bottles, packets of goo, and protein drinks from the side of the road, which I consumed in motion to keep my glycogen and electrolyte levels up. I'd become much more scientific about my nutrition since that Myoplex and Ritz cracker meltdown in San Diego. And with the biggest climb of the day looming into view, I needed to be ready to roar. On a bicycle, mountains produce pain, and pain was my business. As the road peaked in pitch, I put my head down and hammered as hard as I could. My lungs heaved until they were flipped inside out and back again. My heart was a pounding bass line.